From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. By the fall of 1967, America was 2 years into its combat commitment in Vietnam. 500,000 U.S. troops were in the country. 12,000 had already died. Commanding General William Westmoreland was pushing for more troops and more attacks to turn the tide of war. But Vietnam was on the verge of becoming a morass, not the site of American victory. On October 17, 1967, the general's search-and-destroy strategy went terribly awry, and a battalion of the Army's 1st Infantry Division was slaughtered in a brutal ambush 8 long years before the war's eventual end. In a stroke of historical irony, the battle coincided with a pivotal anti-war demonstration at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, a protest that quickly turned into a bloody clash of students and police. Our guest tonight, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Marinus, tells the moving story of those two events in Vietnam and America, and a turning point in war and American history. In a powerful new book, They Marched Into Sunlight, you can join the conversation as American soldiers now wade into an extended occupation of Iraq. Does history from the Vietnam struggle illuminate or obscure America's new war? Are reports from the battlefront now more or less honest than they were then? And were you there in Lai Ke, Vietnam, in Madison? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from Washington is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author David Marinus. He is an associate editor at The Washington Post and author of the new book, They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967. Good evening and welcome, David Marinus.
Good evening, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being with us. It's a terrific book. It's getting all the kudos. Having just read it, I'd say it deserves magisterial, towering, brilliant. And honestly, hats off to you for it.
You
really got to me with this one, had me in tears at points. No one who lived through that time can exactly forget all of it, but yet you brought it back to life and having spent a marvelous summer on that very campus in Madison, not so many years later, I've got kind of an intimate feeling for that, too, studying in Van Hise Hall, South Asian language. But I've got to ask you, David Marinus, the Vietnam War has been written about so much in so many books and so many articles. When you set out to tell this story, the kind of tandem story of events in Vietnam and in Wisconsin and Madison, in October 1967, what was your motivation? How did you decide to dive in all over again?
Well, that was the very motivation, to tell the tandem story. I mean, I know that there was wonderful literature about the war itself in Southeast Asia and some good literature about the anti-war movement, not as much, but I hadn't seen a book that tried to bring those two very different worlds together, different worlds that nonetheless were about the same thing. And I also thought that this might be a good time to do it. I started the book before 9/11, before the war in Afghanistan or Iraq. Mm-hmm. That wasn't on my mind. But what was on my mind was that many of the people whose lives were shaped by that period, by those years in the late 1960s, were now in their middle 50s to middle 60s, feeling their own mortality, and perhaps ready and willing to look back on that era in a more honest and realistic way. And I think that's what I discovered as I began the research for the book.
It comes through in the way you discover that from players on all sides here. There has been a lot of time. People have reconsidered. There's so much detail. It's an astonishingly reported book, deeply reported book. I hope that you'll help us kind of get a feeling for these events tonight with some snapshots from They Marched Into Sunlight. Maybe it'd be good enough just to start by setting, giving us the context for these events of October 1967. What stage was the war at? What stage were U.S. politics and protest at?
Yes. October 1967, everything was still up in the air. The anti-war movement was turning from sort of passive slogans and marches and sing-alongs to more aggressive efforts to stop the war. The culture was changing. It was right after the Summer of Love, the counterculture sort of washing over Midwestern cities like Madison. The war itself was more than about 2.5 years into the American presence there, right at the massive buildup toward and over 500,000 troops. William Westmoreland, the commanding general in Vietnam, still believed that he could win the war through battles of attrition, simply go out and find the Viet Cong, fix them in place, kill them, and we would win. And so therefore he wanted more and more troops to do that. The correspondents in Saigon just then, correspondents like R.W. Apple of the New York Times and Ward Just of the Washington Post, were reporting that the war was at a stalemate, that the Americans were not winning and would not win for 10 years at the earliest, and they would be outweighed by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. Lyndon Johnson was feeling that pressure to prove that he was winning the war. At that very moment in October of 67, he was sending out many of his cabinet secretaries and advisors around the country to make the argument that they were winning. It wasn't a stalemate, and the press was getting it wrong. And that's the moment that I try to capture in this book.
I hope you'll take us then into these two drastically different environments, one in Vietnam, one in the heart of the American Midwest in Madison. First, to the big camp of the Big Red, the first infantry division, the Big Red one. Northwest of Saigon, only about 40 miles. What was the setting for the events that you described there? What was this camp? How important was it? Where did it fit into the military picture of Vietnam?
Well, two brigades of the Big Red One were in Lai Khe, which was about 30-some miles northwest of Saigon, in the jungle between Saigon and Cambodia, a very, very important terrain, not far from the jungles where many of the leaders of the People's Army of Vietnam, or the combination of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, were headquartered in the jungles closer to Cambodia. This was a crucial area which the Americans tried to control. They did fairly well during the daytime, not at all at night. The main artery leading up from Saigon through that area was Route 13, called Thunder Road. Mm-hmm. The battalion that I write about in the book is the 2nd of the 28th Regiment. It's known as the Black Lions Battalion. It was based in Lai Khe and often sent up north of there in the jungle to go on search and destroy missions. It was led by a battalion commander named Terry Allen Jr., who was the son of a famous World War II general, Terry Allen Sr., who had led that very division, the Big Red One, into North Africa in World War II.
One of the most famous, most decorated veterans of that war.
Absolutely, a sort of soldier's officer, beloved by his men, if not by other generals.
But the Black Lions Brigade was
Ernie Pyle.
But it was peopled by, staffed by Americans without glorious anything, really. Just drafted straight out of the heart of America.
Oh, well, the battalion was made up of kids off the street, and the best soldier in the battalion was Clark Welch, who was a first lieutenant commanding his own company, Delta Company.
Out of Durham, New Hampshire.
Not out of West Point, out of New Hampshire, not out of West Point, not out of Officer Candidate School, but commissioned in the field, a former Green Beret. And Clark often said of his men, you know, he loved these kids. He said if they were back in the States, there were probably some hoodlums on the block, but they were his kids, his boys in Vietnam.
You really bring to life how they came from so many parts of the country, thrown onto a troop ship, weeks at sea, getting to Vietnam, and this kind of drastic stage shift from stepping on that boat on one coast to getting off on the other coast, and suddenly, just boom, they're in the middle of jungle, they're in the middle of war, with unbelievable consequences. And they knew that they'd been thrown out there without a whole lot of training and without a whole lot of support.
Some of them had had training back in the States, but it was not anything like Vietnam. And Clark tried to train them for a few weeks, and then they were just thrown out in there. He didn't have the full time that he needed to train them either. And Vietnam, it perhaps is impossible to train for. I mean, you're in a situation where you don't know who the friend is and who the enemy is. There are no front lines. As soon as they got there, they started hearing stories, horror stories about ears being cut off and the Black Lions having, targets for rewards for any killed. And there were shellings every night as soon as they got there into the base camp. So I was like, whoa, what have we got ourselves into here?
They were right into the thick of it. Take us then to the other side of this story as you tell it. And that's the University of Wisconsin campus in Madison.
Yes.
And set up the backdrop there for us. Madison was not just any campus, with not just any lineage when it came to thinking about this war.
Madison and the campus there had a progressive tradition. The Wisconsin idea encouraged interaction between the university and the people and the government. The whole notion of sifting and winnowing was one in which allowed and encouraged dissent and different ways of looking at things. The campus had always had a large influx of students from other parts of the country, a real yeasty environment, a lot of East Coast kids who came there, many of them third and second generation Jewish students whose parents couldn't get into Ivy League schools because of quotas, and so they came out to Wisconsin. And it had a history department that was both excellent and attuned to the notions of American expansion abroad, sort of from the westward expansion. Frederick Jackson Turner actually had written his PhD thesis at Wisconsin.
Towering historian.
Yeah, about the sort of westward manifest mm-hmm. destiny. And then other historians later took that into pushing out of the western frontier toward Asia. And so it had all of those traditions there. It also had an anti-war movement that was one of the most active in the country already. Had been a lot of teach-ins there starting in 1965. And by the fall of 67, there was a more aggressive mood among some of the anti-war leaders on the campus.
By that fall, they were ready to step things up, not just to mild protest, but to real intervention, light years away from the kind of panty raids that you described going on that same fall in other parts of
the
campus.
That's right. Although there was a panty raid that fall, and as I point out in the book, the largest club on campus was still the Young Republicans. So it was a much more variegated place than the stereotypes might imply. But there was a very concerted small group of a couple of hundred people who were intensely active in the anti-war movement and wanted to try to stop whatever connections there were between the university and the war. And that's why they came up with this protest against Dow Chemical Company, the makers of napalm and Agent Orange, who recruited on campuses and had become sort of a symbol of the war on college campuses starting in 1966. A lot of peaceful protests at various places, and at this point in Madison, a decision was made by some of the anti-war leaders to stage an obstructive sit-in inside the Commerce Building where the interviews would be held.
We'll get to each of these explosive events, but very quickly then, you have two other vantages in here. One, in Washington,
yes.
where LBJ is sitting extraordinarily frustrated.
Yeah, I said to myself, okay, we know there was a battle in Vietnam and the protest in Washington, in Madison, what was going on in Washington. It was right at this point I discovered when I went through the transcripts of Johnson's meetings, which were down at the LBJ Library in Austin. It was right at this point when he was telling his cabinet privately that he thought he'd sort of lost control of the war and the anti-war and of the leadership of the country, and he shouldn't run again. And in a haunting moment, there's a 12-hour time difference, Tom, as you know, between Vietnam and Washington.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It was 8 in the morning of the 17th of October in Vietnam. The Black Lions Battalion was marching out of its field camp into the sunlight, into the jungle, towards that awful ambush. At that very moment, it was 8 at night back in Washington, and LBJ was meeting with Robert McNamara, his Secretary of Defense, and Dean Rusk, his Secretary of State, and some others. And he turned to McNamara at that moment and said, "How are we ever going to win?"
And it became clear in that ambush that followed, though it wasn't necessarily told clearly at the time, that it was going to be a very, very tough, long road. We're going to come back and look at the details of the ambush and what went on in Madison, and noting that you, David Moranis, are actually a child of Madison. Your dad edited the newspaper there, so this is very familiar to you. You were a freshman in college in this fall of 67.
I was.
We're with Pulitzer Prize winner David Moranis tonight, talking about 2 days in the fall of 1967, days of Vietnam battle and Vietnam protest. What are the lessons of this history that matter to you today? Is truth always lost in the heat of battle, the heat of protest? Do we have a kind of citizen duty to listen back to these soldiers' stories, the protesters' and policemen's stories? Do you remember when the official Vietnam story unraveled for you? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus about 2 days in the fall of 1967, days of Vietnam battle and Vietnam protest. His new book is They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967. Has Vietnam been on your mind as the country has waded into Iraq? And are these parallel stories or different stories? What are the lessons of this history that matter to you today? David, I wish you'd take us now into the day of this unbelievable ambush and massacre of the Black Lions Battalion. How did it happen? What happened?
I should start with the day before. Black Lions Battalion had been marching around in the Long Wind Secret Zone, a triple canopy jungle area near the Ong Thun Stream, 44 miles northwest of Saigon. And they got into a skirmish on October 16th. Only one soldier was killed in that skirmish, and they were rather successful in dealing with the Viet Cong. Came back to the field camp. Clark Welch was the Delta Company commander in that skirmish. Came back to the field camp and was shocked to learn that the mission for the next day, the operation orders, were to go exactly back to the same place again, try to find the Viet Cong this time and wipe them out.
And why was he shocked? Mistake. Why was that shocking? Why did he think it was a grave mistake?
Well, he thought it would be much wiser to just send in the B-52s or something else take care of it that way.
Because they knew there was a significant force somewhere out there.
Well, they thought there was some force out there somewhere. They didn't quite know how significant, as it turned out. So in any case, he wasn't listened to by Terry Allen, the battalion commander. And as I say in the book, I think that a battalion commander is responsible for his actions, but there was a lot of pressure coming down on Terry Allen from Johnson to pile up the body counts, from Westmoreland to be more aggressive in pursuing the Viet Cong, from the 1st Division General, General Hay, to go out there and find the Viet Cong and pursue them and kill them. And so when Clark Welch said, this is not a wise course, he wasn't heard. So they marched out that morning, starting at 8 o'clock.
Having spent the night, as you describe it, these kids fresh out of America, still fairly fresh, wanting to hear that the bombs in the night and not hearing them. There was not a softening up really.
As Clark Welch said, it was a silent night. He was expecting the thunderous roar of B-52s. It didn't happen. There wasn't even any artillery that he heard.
Before you describe the clash and the ambush, who was waiting on the other side of this conflict? You've also talked with the Vietnamese.
I did. I interviewed in Vietnam with Clark, who went back with me, regimental commander of the 1st Regiment of the 9th Viet Cong Division of the People's Army of Vietnam, a regiment that outnumbered the Americans 8-1. The commander's name was Vo Minh Triet, and he described why he was there, which was, one reviewer said it was like Tolstoy's notion that battles are not won by great leaders or tactics, but by luck. This regiment of the Viet Cong was starving. They were out of rice. They had been eating boiled stinkweed for 2 weeks, and they were scrounging through this part of the Long Wind Secret Zone looking for a rear service attachment that might have rice. They were really supposed to get somewhere else for another battle. And then they heard and saw this the helicopters of the American company and the clanging around in the jungle, and they set up an ambush. They waited for a day and a half. They had scouts in the trees. They had snipers in the trees. They had bunkers set up with rocket-propelled grenades.
And how did they know, how did they think they might lure the Americans into this ambush?
Well, they were very skilled at setting up ambushes. That was their main tactic of battle. And they did it quite simply by letting the Americans see a few of them and follow them in, and then, boom, they were in the trap. And the best soldiers, Clark Welch, a great soldier, didn't hear anything that morning. He didn't want to go that direction, but he didn't hear anything until the trap was sprung.
And this is a soldier, as you describe him, with extraordinary instincts and extraordinary record of success in engagements.
Who was beloved by his men, who had formed his own Delta Company from scratch. Everybody wanted to be with him and with him as his leader.
We're going to hear from Clark Welch in a minute, but tell us the story then of how the Americans stepped in and how that day unfolded.
Well, they Alpha Company was in the lead, Delta Company behind. Both depleted companies, no more than 150 men total, with the battalion command nestled amid the front of Delta Company. And they just walked into this trap after they saw a few Viet Cong. Vo Minh Triet was back in his own makeshift headquarters. He had set up a horseshoe ambush on three sides, one battalion on one side, two on the other, and they waited for his signal. His signal, this is a stunning thing, but one of the leaders of a platoon sergeant in Alpha Company had a habit of singing a soul song, Knock on Wood, every morning as he walked into the field. Mm-hmm. Well, the signal of the Viet Cong, Vo Minh Triet with his scouts in the trees, no one was to act until he knocked three times on a block of wood. Mm-hmm. And then it started, and many hours of horror ensued.
Give us a sense of what that horror meant. This is deep jungle. There was fire coming down from the treetops, fire coming from ground level. The American troops couldn't see where it was coming from, and they quickly realized they were overmatched here.
Oh, they were totally overmatched, outnumbered 8-1. Many of the men said they never really could see any Viet Cong. Some did. Clark Welch did and was able to shoot a few from the trees and coming at him, but many of the men said they'd never felt so overwhelmed and yet isolated at the same time, which seems like a contradiction, but that was the sensation that so many of them described. Withering fire coming from three directions often. And at key points, they were not getting the artillery and mortar support that they needed or wanted. Terry Allen Jr., the battalion commander, made a decision to stay there, not to retreat, and that simply allowed the Viet Cong to tighten the vise. That one of the sayings of the Viet Cong fighters was to grab the enemy by the belt and hold on, which meant to get so close that it made it hard for artillery to support them without wounding or killing the Americans as well. And that's what they were doing here in this three-sided ambush. It was the horror of it I can only describe in a few just simple scenes of a kid named Tom Colburn, who was 18 years old, nicknamed Baby San, was in Delta Company, and he was protected by a tree. There was a sniper above him shooting down on one of his buddies who was in the sunlight. That buddy was calling Tom's name, and Tom couldn't move because he was paralyzed by the realization that if he did, he'd be killed. Mm-hmm. That moment haunted him for the rest of his life. Other soldiers did move. They went after the machine guns and got killed themselves as they tried to take them out. One after another, acts of every type of human reaction in that jungle that morning, an awful morning.
And one by one, dozen by dozen, these young American soldiers were killed. The total death toll on that day, was it
60 killed, 60 wounded out of less than 150. A devastating toll.
And you describe it's just these horrible scenes where they're trying to get out of there, trying to limp out, try to get back to some kind of safety.
Right.
They can't take the dead with them. It's impossible to get them out that day. They stack them like cordwood and lay down a box of artillery fire all night long to keep them from being stripped or taken away by the Vietnamese. And the next day, then, the soldiers required or asked to come into a long tent back at the camp and identify these gruesome remains of the men who were their comrades in arms the day before.
That's right. Yes, identifying the dead. Some of the men didn't want to do it. They got drunk before they had to do it. It was. I can't think of anything that would be more horrific than that. And men who survived the battle said that even that moment was more haunting to them in the years afterwards. Looking through this tent of bodies of men that they'd been alive with the day before.
Among the many, many intimate recollections of this, you found a note that one young soldier, Michael Arias, had written to his mother back in the States after this battle. I wish you'd read it for us, David Marinus.
Yes, all of the soldiers of Alpha Company were asked to write home after the battle, and Michael Arias from Douglas, Arizona, wrote, "Dear Mom, I don't know where to begin, but I must tell you that I'm okay, thanks to God. Remember I told you about Operation Shenandoah 2? Well, the 17th of October, we lost two companies against a Viet Cong regiment. Mom, it was the most terrible 2 hours I've ever spent in my life. Men were dying right and left, and there wasn't anything anyone could do. Out of my platoon, four made it back to our perimeter without a scratch. I was one of the four. I don't know how I did it, but God was with me. P.S. Mom, I lost a lot of good buddies. Love, your son, Michael.
A lot said and a lot unsaid in that note after an unbelievably horrible day. David Marin is standby. I want to welcome to our conversation retired Lieutenant Colonel Clark Welch. He joins us from Florissant, Colorado. He was the Delta Company commander, as you said, of the Army's 1st Infantry Division, 2nd Battalion, 28th Regiment on that day in 1967. This April, he was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the nation's second highest military honor. He was in the Army for 31 years, retired in 1988. Good evening and welcome, Clark Welch.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight. I wonder what it's been like for you, Clark Welch, to have David Marinus pull all this history up in such compelling detail again after all these years. Has it been a torture? Has it been a release? What's it like to read in such vivid detail about that day again?
It has been a wonderful thing. There has been nothing wrong with what David has uncovered. I was afraid of what he was going to uncover, afraid that it wouldn't be what I thought it was going to be. But everything in the greatest detail, and just hearing him talk now, calmly, quietly, accurately, it has been a wonderful thing that he's done for me, changed my life, but for my soldiers. He has just absolutely changed their life. We can talk to each other. He has done a wonderful thing for us.
You, as I understand, were completely unwilling to talk to the press for many years. And even when you first sat down at a hotel, it must have been, a year or two or more ago with David, you almost walked out before the conversation even got going. Can you describe that interaction for us, Clark Welch?
I look back on it now, it's kind of embarrassing. But I was not certain if I should trust David Marinus or not. That's a terrible thing to say now when I've learned that my trusting him completely was the perfect thing to do. But when I first met him, I was very apprehensive. And as you said, I hadn't spoken to anyone for 32, 33 years. And we had arranged to meet in a hotel in downtown Denver. We were sitting at a table with cups of coffee in front of us. And after a few minutes of just introducing each other, I said, David, I can't talk to you unless you promise to treat my men well. But you've got to promise to treat my men well. And David just looked right at me and said, Clark, I can't do that. I can't promise to do that. And I stood up and started to leave, and he said in a loud voice, which just absolutely, he said, Clark, I can't promise to treat your men well. I can promise to tell the truth. And that just absolutely stopped me, and I turned around and came back, and I've never asked him to do that again. Mm. In my business, I'd never had anybody tell me that they were going to tell the truth, because in my business, you must tell the truth. But from this man who I did not know what I was going to do with, mm-hmm. I can't promise that, but I can promise to tell the truth.
But you saw, Colonel Welch, you saw on that day in its aftermath in 1967
yes.
that the truth was not told.
Oh, absolutely. It was.
How did the military present what happened on that day?
It's very difficult for me to look back at it now, but what I heard from the military and when I tried to track it down was that a battalion had stumbled into the jungle and two of the very senior officers had been killed, and that was about it. And it was kind of presented as a victory, and the two senior officers were very famous. It didn't say anything about the incredible bravery of my men, and that really bothered me.
It must have, and for a long time. David,
bothered me until, still bothers me now that they didn't handle it right 36 years ago.
And it should. Why that misrepresentation, David, and how high did it go? How widely was it portrayed that way?
Well, it went all the way to General Westmoreland himself, who came to Lycay the next day and said, no, this was not an ambush. This was a meeting engagement. It went to General Hay, the division commander, who insisted that it was merely a mistake on Terry Allen's part. It went to the Military Assistance Command Vietnam press release, which declared it a victory in which 102 Viet Cong soldiers were killed. Only in the last graph, 4 pages later, does it say that 60 Americans died in this battle. Doesn't mention Delta Company or Clark Welch at all. Doesn't really portray the battle in any accurate way. And it went even to an incredible document I stumbled upon in which General Hay, the commanding general of the 1st Division, was awarded a Silver Star for this very battle. which he had nothing to do with and didn't arrive in the field camp until well after it was over. And the only information I could get about what he did there was to chew out one of the soldiers who was crying after what he had endured.
So the telling was a
completely
farce.
Fabricated Silver Star award, which, you know, is such a dishonor to the men who fought that day.
Peter's calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great show. I'm probably one of your most conservative listeners, which may be an oxymoron, who also happens to be an undergrad at BU and a law school grad, has been a practicing attorney for 1974. Not that that is...
It's great to have you.
Yeah, but more important, I'm an alumni of the 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, 1st Marine Division. I served in Vietnam from January 68 to February 69. I haven't had the opportunity to read the book. I think it sounds like an excellent book to read.
It's tremendous.
The point that I was would like to just make is I kind of have positioned myself as the unofficial spokesman for Marine grunts that went through a lot of combat. And unfortunately, most of them don't have spokesmen for the accomplishments they did. Mm. And I guess the point I would make is that there's a lot of, at the same time, in my particular company, and the reason I say my outfit is there's so many phonies out there that claim Vietnam service and that weren't veterans. But in October of 67, it was you mentioned where were people, and I know exactly. I was in a place called Parris Island in October 67.
Getting ready.
Getting ready, right, and joined my company in late January 68, right before the Tet Offensive. But my company was in I know hotels company's history. In October of 67, they were on Operation Medina up in Quang Tri, and they had enormous casualties, which was typical of the casualties in I Corps. And the lessons, I guess the generic lessons that I would just draw from that and just throw out to the listeners, there's also, that is never really emphasized too much, I detest the right-wing flag wavers who are always ready to send troops in who've never been in combat. And there's so many of those people. But conversely, the anti-military people types were also off the wall, who just, you know, totally were against any type of military situations. And it was very easy back in, again, I don't know what your age is, but back in 65 to 70 when the war was going on, it was pretty easy to avoid the draft if you were in college.
It sure was. Peter, we're out of time in this section, but thanks for your call. We'll come back and look at the other half of that equation. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus about 2 days in the fall of 1967, days of Vietnam battle and Vietnam protest. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Clark Welch is with us as well. What are the lessons of this history that matter to you today? And do we have a kind of citizen duty to listen back to these soldiers' stories, the protesters' and the policemen's stories? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize winner David Marinus about 2 days in the fall of 1967, days of Vietnam battle and Vietnam protest. His new book is They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967. We are also joined tonight by retired Lieutenant Colonel Clark Welch, who was there in Vietnam on that day, October 17th, when so many American troops marched into the jungle and to their death, a kind of hero he emerges from this book. Has Vietnam been on your mind as the country has waded into Iraq? Are these parallel stories or different stories? Does facing history ease an old ache or revive it? And were you there on the jungle battleground on the streets of Madison? Peter's calling from Plymouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. Hello, David. This is Peter Miller calling. From
Peter
Delta
Miller,
Delta.
Yes.
How are you?
Very good, sir. Good to hear from you.
Well, good to hear from you. I just wanted to comment. I've read the book, and boy, I've learned an awful lot.
Peter, are you familiar with what happened on that day?
He was there.
You were there?
Oh, yeah.
What was your rank? What was your role, Peter Miller?
I was a rifleman with Delta Company. And I was just with Delta Company. How you doing, Lieutenant Welch?
I'm doing fine. I thought that was you.
Yeah.
Your voice sounds wonderful. Man, I wish I could be there with you.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to call and just say that The book answered a lot of questions for me.
What kind of questions? You were there. What questions did you still need answered, even though you were on the scene in Vietnam, Peter?
Well, a lot of the stuff with the officers and the cover-up and everything else, you know, we were really cut off from the world. And the things like with the artillery the night before, the no B-52 strike
mm-hmm.
coming in,
mm-hmm.
The business with General Hay, just so many things that we never really got answers to.
Peter, were you with the very group that took so many casualties on that day?
Oh, yes, yeah.
He was.
And how did you survive?
Well, I was wounded, and, you know, I had a little bout of malaria, and then I went back and spent seven more months out there.
May I ask you, I will ask the same thing of Clark Welch, but how do you think back on that day? How do you remember it? Do you block it out? It's decades now. What's your experience been?
I've thought of it every day for the last 35 years. It's something, though, that for 35 years, I've never really talked about it any great length. It's just, you know, you put it kind of in the back of your head, and this book has been very helpful. I think I know personally for me anyway. Again, with just kind of putting it all in perspective and answering questions, and it was a pretty horrible thing.
Peter, you're a veteran of that day. Let me just ask you: when you look out at what's going on in Iraq now, do you think the country learned from Vietnam? Do you think the country's doing things better, treating its troops better, or not?
I don't know about whether treating its troops better. I think the country has always treated its troops fine. I don't think it's a case of the country against the troops or
yep.
anything. The troops are always supported. But I think we don't learn from mistakes that we make. I really believe that. We've made some terrible, terrible mistakes, and I think we continue to make mistakes. And things go on, you know. With this business in Iraq, it's two today, three tomorrow. It's horrible stuff. My heart goes out to those guys. My heart goes out to them because it wounds people. And not in a physical sense alone. It's not good. It's not a way to solve our problems. Mm.
Peter Miller, a rifleman with the Delta Company in October of 1967, thank you very much for calling in.
See you later, Lieutenant. And thanks again, David.
Great to hear you. Things are better now, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They really are. Mm-hmm. It was, and it's been good talking to you guys, you know, and back in Vegas last October and seeing the guys. And it's been very, very good.
Peter, thanks for calling. Clark Welch, let me put the same question to you. When you look out at Iraq today, as Peter Miller said, there's this terrible drip of casualties at a much smaller scale than we saw in Vietnam. Do you see similarities here? Do you see differences? Are they worth comparing in your mind?
Of course it's worth comparing. I think primarily with me, where I spent my life working about these kind of things, and when I found out about something, I wanted to do something about it. And I'm no longer in a position to do that. I read the paper, I listen to the radio, I watch TV the same as everyone else, and I've never been one to talk about things or think about things without doing something. And in my case now, I don't have anything to do. You know, I'm not writing orders, I'm not taking a helicopter into Iraq, not anymore.
But there's something you can do right here, right now, I think for us, is give us your perspective on Iraq. Do you feel, after all you were through in the U.S. military, what you went through on that day in October 67, do you feel that this is being done right?
I really don't know. The battles are awful. It makes me cry when I hear about a soldier being hurt or being wounded. It is so different, but yet it's so much the same. The terrain is different. The enemy is different. The weather is different. Our soldiers are the same. The soldiers, and I joined the Army in 1957, the soldiers are the same. No better, no worse. We train them, we lead them. They don't get the leaders they deserve. It's a shame, a crying shame. It tears my heart out to hear the boys being hurt. There are similarities, but it's so different also.
David Marinus, take us then to the other side of this equation, because it was a pivotal day, not just in Vietnam, but back in the United States. And what was it that happened in Madison, and what did it signify what happened in Madison that day?
What happened in Madison is that everything went wrong. You had a group of students staging an obstructive sit-in inside the Commerce Building. Most of them thought that they were participating in an act of civil disobedience where they would be arrested, go limp, hauled off to jail, much like in the civil rights movement. You had a few students who wanted to stir things up more than that, unbeknownst to the majority. You had a UW administration, a chancellor, Bill Sewell, a good man, great sociologist who had no experience as an administrator, could not think of any creative ways to defuse the situation, allowed the Madison City Police to come onto the scene. City Police, who had no training in riot training at all. A few had, and they were trained by the Chicago Police Force, of all things, because we know what happened with them in a few months in Chicago. And so you had a very volatile situation that turned very bad quickly. The police moved into that building. There was some pushing and shoving. It was too overcrowded. It was like being in a submarine in there. All of a sudden, the police, some of whom really wanted to bash some heads of these spoiled brat protesters, as they thought of them, you know, who were protesting while their brothers and friends were over in Vietnam fighting. There was some bit of a class warfare struggle going on in that building as well, and it got very bloody. Cops came in, kids came out with bloody heads. And at a crucial moment, Bill Sewell, the chancellor, was in his office looking out at this awful scene, and his son, a graduate student, came rushing into his office and said, Dad, can't you stop it? They're beating the hell out of the kids. And he said, no, it's too late. I'm afraid my career is ruined. And he was haunted by that moment for the rest of his life.
Did something change on that day in Madison, in the country, in the way American citizens interacted around this war?
Well, I don't want to make too much of that particular event for the rest of the country. I think there were different moments of change and awakening in different places. And it had a lot of different contradictory effects. To some people who watched that event, they thought it was police brutality. And many freshmen I interviewed said it sort of awakened them to the world and to authority and abuse of authority. And it had them, led them on the path of questioning what was going on in the world. Some people reacted thinking it was an ugly act of student violence, and so they were alienated from the anti-war movement by then. I think there were these different fissures and fractions going on, and all part of the incredible energy of that time, and it certainly represented the beginning of a much more intense, aggressive, difficult period in the anti-war movement.
David Halberstam reviewed your book rather glowingly, and he looks back on the Vietnam War and says in his review that a reason this war doesn't go away is that it was in some ways America's second civil war, that pitting the country not just against the North Vietnamese, but against itself as well. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that, and is that rift still there somehow?
I agree with it mostly. I think the rift is, there are rifts that are still there from that, but, you know, the point of this book, if there is one, is to try to deal with that, mm-hmm. you know, in an honest way. Maybe I'm naive, but I think I can write a book that says, look, dissent is an important part of the American democratic fabric, and you can honor soldiers at the same time, you know, that in the most idealistic world, what are the soldiers fighting for? The right of people in the country to dissent. In the most idealistic notion, what are the protesters doing? They're trying to save the lives of soldiers, mm-hmm. not just themselves. Mm-hmm. Now, that's naive and idealistic, but I think that it's an important thought to keep in mind, and it's what, you know, I'm trying to bring back the reality of this time and place. That's sort of an underlying theme that runs through it. And as I've traveled around the country with this book tour and found the reaction of the Vietnam veterans and of people who were at Wisconsin, it's been, you know, maybe just for that single moment that they're together in a room, but it's been quite something.
Mike's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. I was born in 77. I obviously can't remember the Vietnam War, and I've heard my parents talk about that time. And up until now, I simply could not understand how people of their generation could get into riots, could dodge the draft, could break the law. And now, as I see these young men dying for Halliburton stock price, I can understand it. and I'm willing to do whatever I need to do to get them home. I'm wondering if my feeling is felt by other people of my generation around the country. I don't know if you could even speculate on that.
Well, Mike, let's put it to David Marinus. Do you feel a kind of echoing between these two wars, David? Is it too early to say? I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, the Vietnam label has begun to kind of creep up. Frank Rich, the New York Times over the weekend,
yes.
And here and there, suddenly you see, I don't know, is it people of a certain age who just can't help but feel at the back of their throat the kind of catch, oh, my gosh, is this familiar?
Well, The caller is not of that age, so
yeah.
But he's starting to understand it. I agree with Clark. The wars themselves militarily are completely different, but human nature tends not to change, and I think we are feeling some of those echoes again. And I think that one difference is that there's no draft today, and I think the draft fueled a lot of the energy of the anti-war movement in the 60s and created a daily discussion among any male who was not in the military about what will you do if you oppose the war, will you go fight or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's different. I think that there is a growing unease, and it reminds me in some ways, even as different as the wars are, it reminds me in some ways of October 67, where you have a president who is trying to say that that they're prevailing and that the press is getting it wrong. That's where we are today, and it's where we were in October of 67.
Clark Welch, when you look back on that day, did you feel abandoned in that jungle? Did you feel that your leaders had led you wrong and led you and your men into the maw of death there?
Yes, I did. I was quite sure of that, from my leader on up through the President of the United States. But my whole focus was on my company, my 100 or the 60 people that I had left out of my 150 that I'd started with. And during the day, during the fight, there was never a thought where I said, damn, this is President Johnson's fault. During the fight, it was strictly keeping my men alive and doing the best I could. But yes, I knew the leaders had not done their job.
And you saw right up close why it's so important that job be done. And on the Madison side, David Marinus, just got a few seconds left, but how does your hometown look back on this month, these days now?
It looks back on it as one of those turning point moments in modern American history. So many people that I was just back in Madison, and so many people came up to me and said either they were there or they'll never forget that day. And it changed their lives forever, just like the veterans in Clark Welch, in a very different way, but the same couple of days in 67 changed their lives.
David Marinus, it's a terrific book. I think majestic,
thank
towering,
you.
Brilliant. I give it all those. And thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
And retired Lieutenant Colonel Clark Welch, thank you for your service then, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
David Marinus's book is They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.